Welcome to The Chat Room, the podcast on humanitarian action by the Center for Humanitarian Action in Berlin. Today, CHAR Director Ralf Südhoff welcomes Hugo Slim to The Chat Room. He joined us as a panelist at the CHAR conference this year and took the time to come to our podcast studio and talk about prioritization in humanitarian aid.
Hugo, many thanks for joining us here at CHAR Annual Conference as keynote speaker and in our conference podcast room in our little studio. Many thanks for joining.
It's an absolute pleasure, always a pleasure to be with CHAR.
Hugo, you are well known today as a senior research fellow at the University of Oxford. You've been the former Red Cross ICRC head of policy. You published on challenges to modern humanitarianism with your book Solferino 21, which we could launch together 2 years ago in Berlin. Why now you work on a climate project, if I'm not misled, co-funded also by, for example, the German Red Cross and Caritas Germany, which is very interesting because it's also feeding to the topic we want to discuss today. Because lately you have been engaged maybe in the recently most important, surely most dominant international debate about future humanitarian policy and practice on the prioritization debate, which has gathered immense international momentum. Maybe just roughly on the background, you can share much better in a second. Humanitarian needs have been only funded 40% last year. Some forecast in future it might be only 25% anymore or even less due to, for example, disastrous climate change impact on humanitarian crisis multiplying needs. But at the same time, humanitarian budgets are shrinking, and forecasts for humanitarian budgets, particularly in Germany, Europe, as well as the US, are pretty grim. Lately, we had a discussion with our Center for Humanitarian Action, our European colleagues at the European Humanitarian Forum in Brussels on this prioritization issue, and it was very interesting with leading donors, but providing also a sense how much orientation we all are seeking and looking for, and that guidance is really needed, what prioritization could mean and how to do it best in times of exceeding needs and shrinking funds. But maybe to start with that one, you have put an essay and an article before, very interesting criteria, very interesting proposals, how to best prioritize. And you had the courage, which is really much appreciated because I think we lack a lot of courage for a start, putting something on the table which can be provocative, inspiring, etc. But maybe starting with why have you chosen the topic and why is it so important from your view?
Thank you, Ralph. So I think I decided to write on prioritization because I was asked to write as well on humanitarian needs. So while I was thinking about needs, I inevitably thought about prioritization. But I was also thinking about it because of my research on the climate emergency, because I was, and I am now, arguing that humanitarians should be responsive to and compassionate to the needs of nature as well. So in that context, I was also trying to consider how do we make decisions between the needs of humans and the needs of the natural environment around us, and of course the vital mutualism between them, which often means we know we can meet both needs at the same time. So it was about my climate work and about thinking about humanitarian needs at a time when governments were giving less and less money.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, and about this new dimension you cover also in your climate work on the needs of nature, I think really important to discuss maybe in a minute. I mean, first of all, maybe sharing for the ones who haven't read your essay, currently you put 7 criteria on the table in an essay, which we will share in the show notes. Whom to prioritize in a world of overwhelming needs. And some of the criteria might not come as a major surprise, like the very first one on urgency, which sounds pretty familiar if you compare it to the humanitarian principle of humanity, impartiality, and following a needs-based approach. You also mentioned differential suffering, as you call it, meaning capacity plays a role. Like, for example, with current floods in southern Germany, of course, you wouldn't prioritize aid in a country like Germany, which has the capacity to provide aid itself. And you relate that also to middle-income countries who might have the capacity, etc. However, other criteria many humanitarians usually outcry about, as they might come across as political, conditional, etc. And you argue against, to share some example as an intro, you argue against aid under regimes like the Taliban. You mentioned criteria like be looking at cultural, social issues, as you also propose to allow proximity to become a key criteria for that, or to prioritize future generations by investing in disaster prevention over aid for current generations suffering right now, if I may quote, to prioritize statistical lives of the future over actual lives in the present. How do you see reactions so far on these themes?
Well, I think the truth is, Ralph, you probably hear more reactions than I do because humanitarians are extraordinarily polite. And they don't often send me a text message saying, you're a complete jerk, this is appalling, you know, how can you write this? They tend not to. They might say something like, that was interesting, which in English, of course, is a fairly damning remark. But they don't come at me very often. But, you know, so they're, I haven't been attacked particularly and challenged about this, except in one or two conversations, quite rightly, when I'm with people and they want me to explain myself like you do now.
Well, let's see which reaction we get for the podcast, and happy to share with you in a very straightforward manner if we do get any. But maybe sharing in the first place what you put on the table. Some of the theses in your essay are linked, I think, to your previous book, Solferino. A main threat is that overall we need to reprioritize humanitarian aid in a life-saving or life-keeping manner, but not to engage in life-making anymore. At one point you said lately this debate is not so much the way donors like to frame it, for example, to do more with less by just becoming more efficient, but it's about doing less with less. What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if there is less money, then we are going to have to do less. So we need to prioritize. We need to decide what's really important. And therefore, I was saying, I think, you know, life saving and life keeping. So that the saving of life in an urgent situation and the maintenance of life in a difficult situation. I think humanitarianism has crept up the developmental ladder in the last 20 years and has been involved in life-making, trying to ensure that people are living well in every area of their life, you know, economies, business, mental health, and, you know, sort of all manner of human rights are now considered to be issues of protection for humanitarian agencies. I think we have to be more focused than that if there's less money.
In doing less with less, you name a couple of criteria how to prioritize. A really great inspiration. I think we rarely see this in our sector, as said, to put really something on the table and not just say, well, we might need to reconsider principle X, Y, Z, etc. Having said that, I was surprised about the focus of most of the outlined criteria. For a start, you look for a series which would make humanitarian aid indeed conditional in a political sense or linked to national interest, which is often controversial, or linked to good governance of a specific country, or as said, the proximity of a crisis. Many criteria which we know very well from the past related to development engagements, stabilization, security policies. But the question probably by the traditional humanitarians would be, how does that link to your first criteria of urgency and the principle of a needs-based approach?
Mm-hmm. So this whole basis of this essay, this blog for GPPI in Berlin is simply the assumption that the climate emergency, and as we seem to see it now, war, is going to create more and more humanitarian need. So we have to have additional criteria. In other words, we can all share a universalism, which is the principle of humanity, that we want to protect life and health and ensure respect for the human beings everywhere, but we can't. Okay, that's and capacity is a very important moral fact. And if we can't, because our agency only has X million or our government's only giving, you know, XX million, then we need additional criteria to this general principle of impartiality that we should help everyone. So I'm trying to say, well, how would you calibrate further when you cannot be universally impartial? And nobody can. And so the first thing I say is that, you know, we're lucky enough to live in a world now which is richer. It's a multipolar world where we have the US, Europe, China, India, Latin America has great wealth, Southeast Asia has great wealth. We can now acknowledge a distribution of labor, a division of labor. So not every human life in danger is necessarily a German responsibility because it's closer to China. China's better placed to respond. China has existing relationships along the Belt and Road in those areas. It's probably more a Chinese responsibility. Therefore, that's one criteria which allows the German aid budget to think, well, where should we really focus? Where, you know, we are the prime players in the humanitarian system of systems, because I believe it is a system of systems. We all need to be universal. The Chinese need to be universal. The Indians need to be universal in their humanitarian commitments, but they cannot be everywhere for various geographical, financial, and political reasons. So we need to get that division of labor sorted out. And so the second point you raise, and so that's really about feasibility. It's about what is possible to do, and we have to be pragmatic and realistic. And much as we, you know, I think the fear is that if we start focusing, we're somehow decommitting ourselves from the principle of universalism. But we're not. I'm a universalist, but I'm a realistic universalist who cannot save everybody all of the time, everywhere. Therefore, I have to make choices. And I do that in my personal life all the time, and so do you, and so does everyone listening. And we have to do that with humanitarian budgets, too.
Interesting comparison too, because I think it's very interesting to compare the public humanitarian funding with patterns of private donations. Some people might say, well, one thing is to accept that people relate to proximity, they rather donate to countries they know, they've been to, etc., while they might argue, well, public funding should follow more objective criteria and the principles. Turning that into a question, this idea of international or global division of labor and everybody taking care of the regions and the countries where relations and interconnections are best, doesn't that follow the assumption we have a global agreement that everybody should engage in these efforts and that China, India, Russia, Brazil need to engage in the Arabic world, where we have a debate for decades now that it would need to engage much more for a start at all the Arabic crisis? But it doesn't really fly. So some might say, well, that sounds like a good idea, but also as a naive one because it hasn't worked for the past decades. Why should it work now?
Well, let's see if it works any better. I mean, I think part of their responsibility, if we're all arguing for a multipolar world with different regions, different spheres of influence, different responsibilities, people have to take up those responsibilities. So part of your job is to encourage other systems to develop and take on their responsibility. The alternative is that, you know, our lovely Western countries say we can do the whole world. So then we have a huge pot of money, which we'll never get, and then we won't be able to do the whole world. Because President Putin's not going to let us into Russia. President Xi is not going to let us into China. Most, you know, certain Latin American countries are not going to let us in that. So it's a silly idea to say that we can do everything. So much better that, you know, German NGOs, many others, encourage humanitarianism with Chinese characteristics, with Indian characteristics in other parts of the world, I think. You keep talking about proximity and those things. I want to, as we say in English, grasp that nettle, that stinging nettle. So proximity does have moral importance to me. Okay, it is a moral reality that we have particular obligations to those closer to us. And we see that all around the world. We see Jordanians, Lebanese, Turkish governments taking in Syrian refugees because they're near, because there are family relationships across the border, because they are part of the region, and it's possible to do it because they're close, okay? Now, we don't criticize them and say, that's outrageous! How dare you look after Syrians? You should be looking after Somalis, and quite obviously looking after Sudanese. We don't say that. It makes moral sense that they look after their neighbors. And it's the same.
Those Syrians came to their place in the first place, right?
Well, yes, exactly.
They've been fleeing to their countries.
That's right. And they accepted them and looked after them and, you know, took on elements of responsibility there with international support, obviously. But we don't criticize them for doing that, but not other things. So I think, you know, it's the same with the West. If the West has a major crisis on its border with people it wants to be European or feels a European already or whatever, considers as neighbors, they have a primary call on that. And to me, that's, you know, that's not racist, that's not unfair, that's moral realism, that actually those obligations, those ties are close. And I think the other thing is you can't suddenly say to the West as well, you know, you're unfair to Ukrainians, because the West has always responded at great depth in countries like Syria, Ethiopia, Somalia, for decades, investing lots of money there too. So you can't say they're biased. It's not a question that they only help people who are close. It's a question that sometimes they especially help people who are close, while they also help and have helped for 20, 30, 40 years, people who are far away.
A very fair point. Under the current momentum and need by shrinking budgets for prioritization, one concern might be, well, that open the Pandora box of allowing and even legitimizing to go via proximity, national interest, security issues, which of course are related to Ukraine crisis as well, etc. Do we allow also Western governments to get off the hook and basically trust? And well, if we allow them to focus on the Ukraine, which indeed compared is over proportionally well funded, the humanitarian response compared to South Sudan, many crises in Africa, etc. Is there a risk that we let the Western countries off the hook, while our trust that the other ones might pick up in a fairly needs-based approach, even if it's only focusing on their regions, might not fly? I mean, India will never provide substantial humanitarian assistance for floods in Pakistan, in the enemy country. China will very much link whatever it does, even in its region, to national interest. So is there a risk that we lose this idea overall, which of course is questioned, but that we lose the whole momentum of a principled needs-based approach, even in the Western world, while it's not really picked up in the rest?
There's a danger, but I don't think we should let, we mustn't let, you know, I'm a Western liberal, Christian, you know, whatever. I don't want my society, my region, my country to let go of that essential universalism. So it's our job to make sure they don't. It's not necessarily our job to make sure China follows us or India follows us. You know, they have very different countries to run in very different regions with, you know, different resources and civilizational resources as well. So I think the main thing for us is to make sure we don't lose that commitment and model it and be an example in the world. And I'm sure in particular crises, we will see humanity rising in other parts of the world increasingly. And, you know, you mustn't forget that within China, they probably respond to emergencies with more people affected per year than the international, what we call the international Western system. You know, when there are floods in China, when there's heat waves in China, when there's earthquakes in China and whatever, the numbers involved are huge. So China's humanitarian responsibilities within China could well be bigger than the West's international responsibilities. So we have to recognize that too. And the same for India in some ways, not perhaps less so now. But so there are genuine differences, and our job is to make sure we stand for what we believe in, which is universal and impartial, but I would say not always possible. And, you know, create a system of systems where others find their own way to help people in disasters. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very, very valid point that very often we overlook what's under the radar of the international humanitarian system and what's provided locally and nationally and not going via the UN-dominated system, etc. Final question on this issue, on this question and criteria. If we relate to, for example, we have a very heated debate right now in Germany because you might have heard that once again the German Foreign Office has been asked to cut its budget by a quarter for next year, and that would mean to potentially even half humanitarian aid coming from Germany. The Liberal Party, having the vice chancellor and the finance ministry in place, so it's not really some marginal political power, has last week for the first time put on the table, well, let's make just political criteria the key one for providing humanitarian aid, not anything else, not development, security support, but humanitarian aid, by providing assistance only to countries who, for a start, support our alliance against Russia. What would you tell these politicians in the light that maybe some political criteria might be okay in future?
So I would say they're wrong to make a blanket policy like that. But as I say in my paper, I think there are times where you might use those criteria in prioritizing. So I think, you know, if you have a choice, there are needs across three or four countries, and there's one country, you know, say it's Mali or Burkina or Niger now, where the Russians have basically taken control, you might think, okay, well, they're there, they can do it. You know, they've decided to take the dominant hegemonic role in the Sahel, they can do it. We'll go somewhere else where we can get better access, etc. So there, you know, it's there will be times when you have to prioritize because of geopolitics and regional politics, because you simply can't get in and you can't. That makes sense. But to say it as a general rule is wrong, because there will be times when, you know, that loyalty could be coerced. It could be, you know, not a general opinion, etc., across populations, and we still have access to it and can play a constructive role in that context. So I think it would be wrong to make that a blanket rule, because there will be very particular cases where Western aid is best placed to respond to people's needs in an area which may still, in some issues, support an enemy or whatever. So I think we have to be variable about that. However, the other question that I raise in this paper is political, and I'm very hard on the Taliban, and I always will be until they change their policy on women, which I consider to be a crime against humanity. So I would not want, I'm British, I would not want the British government investing in the Taliban as a government to meet humanitarian needs. I would find that immoral, because it means tolerating what they're doing. And to me, it would be like in the 1930s in Europe, in our own continent, if, you know, Mussolini's government in the 30s said, oh, we'd love the British to come and invest in our health system and that sort of thing. And that would be intolerable to me. There comes lines where you have to say, actually, there's something more important morally than the suffering of those people. And I would rather support them directly through ideas of humanitarian resistance or humanitarian insurgency and cross-border and other ways. That makes sense to me. And then the other exception, I think, as well, around governments is corruption. I think if I had a choice as a, you know, government between investing increasingly scarce humanitarian money between a country that was corrupt and a country that was not, I would invest it in the country that was not, or invest much more in the country that was not, because genuinely it'll have a better humanitarian return. It will not be stolen. It will not be diverted. It will not end up back in a Swiss bank account. So I think corruption has to be taken seriously too, as well as politics, in humanitarian prioritization.
A very interesting point, also relating to one of your other criteria you share on the capacity on the ground and on corruption / good governance. Probably the counter argument people would put on the table is to say, well, the worst humanitarian crises are in exactly these countries where you don't like the regime, where there's a conflict because nobody likes the regime, including their own population. So if we look at Syria crisis for 12 years now, if we look at Gaza right now, if we look at Afghanistan, at Yemen. Following this line, one might argue, well, we should have never substantially supported Syrians fleeing inside Syria, the Assad regime, because it's a corrupt regime. We should not provide assistance in Gaza because Hamas is not taking care of its own population, even if they could, and if the war would be over, etc. So is there a risk of simplifying, because the ambition of agencies, of course, is to provide aid to the people, circumventing the government wherever possible and not supporting the government directly? So, of course, you have a point, any kind of support and any kind of making conditions a bit better will always indirectly also benefit a current government. Is there a risk that it's too oversimplifying, saying, well, we just move out of these corrupt regimes, and if we look around the globe, well, there is even a rise of authoritarian regimes, and with that coming a lot of corruption many times.
So with the rise of authoritarian regimes, I think European aid will change, because I think it will do what I was suggesting. It won't be able to invest directly in Mussolini-type governments around the place. So it'll have to find new ways of working, which might be humanitarian resistance, it might be other forms of support. It might just be we can't do anything, because to do anything means we have to work with a really bad government. But thinking longer term, if you look at South Sudan, which you mentioned earlier, I mean, that's got to be the classic example, hasn't it, of working with fairly useless, corrupt, you know, elites fighting over the same country for, you know, almost 15 years now. Where's it got the people of Sudan? What's been the value for money? These important things count in humanitarian decision-making, and maybe actually that was not the right way to do it, you know. It just has allowed a practice of global welfare, international welfare payments, basically, to citizens of South Sudan endlessly, to permit the government not to govern and just to keep fighting its rivals. And, you know, we have to take those kind of cases seriously and say, well, we don't want to do that. We don't want to get on that path. So let's look at other ways of engaging with dysfunctional states. And I think you have to be realistic as a humanitarian, because you're using valuable money which could go to people, you know, who are not corrupt and whatever, and are not going to waste it or exploit it or have no intention of making their citizens' lives better.
Would you go that far that this calls for rethinking humanitarian aid and making it more conditional, even without talking about prioritization? I mean, it's not, even without the pressure, it would have an inner logic, what you're saying, that we need to be honest that this approach hasn't worked in the past, from your view?
So you can be honest about it. I think we should be, yeah. I think I'm not using the word conditional. I'm not using that kind of 90s, 80s language, that sort of, you know, World Bank conditionality language. I'm saying these are ethical choices which are made, you know, on the basis of what's an important use of money, humanitarian money, which is important. Where can we spend it best? Where are we going to get, you know, people going to get best humanitarian return? These are important things, and I'm not saying it's conditional. I'm saying look where you can actually operate fairly and well without supporting an authoritarian or a regime we wouldn't like for the next 20 years, which is basically what's happened in South Sudan.
Final question on that one. Many agencies would argue, well, it's a myth that we can't work in most of these countries, even under a specific regime. Like, for example, in Afghanistan, many claim, well, we have worked in all the Taliban provinces well ahead of the Taliban taking over Kabul. It worked well. We can do a people's approach, which is not related to local authorities, etc. And by that, we can help the ones who are the most needy, actually, because, of course, people living under these dictatorships are usually the ones suffering most. Is that a...
That's great. I'm very happy with that. I call that humanitarian resistance, you know, and I'm seeing a lot of it in Myanmar, and I think that's right. And if it's happening in Afghanistan, great. I think that's important. If you know, humanitarian funds can be used that way. I don't feel it's essential to be neutral as a humanitarian. So if people are hoping, you know, trying to be humane and trying to win at the same time, that's okay with me. Some of the most important humanitarian acts in history and in recent history have been done by non-neutral humanitarians who are rescuing people from cities in Ukraine, and the same in Myanmar. So, yes, those other ways are important, and we need to rediscover them. When I started, they were being done in Latin America every day and in apartheid South Africa. We need to find those ways again.
On neutrality, probably we could do a separate podcast, so maybe not deep diving more into that debate, but touching on the point you made at the very beginning that your current climate project made you think at the same time about nature as a target group of humanitarian aid in a way, and having a more comprehensive approach. Maybe for one, you could quickly elaborate why you come to this conclusion, and maybe already touch also on the question. A lot of what you say is very interesting about refocusing to a core humanitarian mandate. That sounds like broadening it immensely in a period of prioritization. How does that come to
you? You mustn't expect me to be too consistent. I'm a person of contradictions as well, like we all are. But I think I can do both. So what I'm saying about nature, and in my book that's coming out in October, I am actually insisting that we completely revise the principle of humanity and we completely revise the principle of impartiality. We move beyond the 1965 definitions we have for the new world of an earth emergency, as I call it, because the climate is creating an earth emergency for all the earth community, all species, humans, everyone. We have to find a new doctrine of humanity, as I call it in my book, which recognizes that humanity is not some special species that lives above the earth somehow. We are earthy and an earth-based species, and we are part of the earth community, and we cannot live without the earth or the earth community of nature. So I'm therefore arguing that we have to care about the earth community in order to survive, and because we love it anyway. And we need a new we. We've done great work in the last 150 years to establish the we of humanity, that we as a species are one, we can share common values, and we need to do that an even bigger we now for the earth community, saying all of us, nature, we are one in the earth community, and we must show compassion to the whole earth community. Humanity is not just for humans, it's for nature. So that's my basic argument. And then, of course, you're right to say, well, blimey, that's going to need 25 new departments and 38 new directors, and we're going to need new budgets. And I'm going to say no, because I'm going to say that we don't need to focus in the same way on the individual human as much as we have and count everything in terms of people in need. We're going to have to change our unit of analysis as humanitarians and look at landscape instead of individual humans. And we're going to have to look at landscapes together and see how humans and nature live mutually in those landscapes and respond to both. And that doesn't mean that MSF has to get bigger, CARE has to get bigger, or, you know, whatever, the Red Cross has to get bigger. I think it needs merging different organizations. So, as I was saying this morning at the conference, for example, I think MSF needs to team up with veterinary agencies, ecological agencies, and if it's really serious about sans frontierism, it needs to go beyond human borders to nature and think of one health for a landscape. If it doesn't want to do that, it can stay working in war or do what it wants to do. But I think we need these big mergers and combined approaches of ecological and nature organizations working with humanitarians. And I think unless we do that, you know, our small sector that only works on humans will look very bizarre and very irrelevant in particular landscapes, and possibly become extinct, except in war.
And probably everybody would sign up to, well, we need a comprehensive perspective on this multiple crisis. We need to protect nature, because if we don't protect nature, we will, for a start, create the next humanitarian crisis and needs, etc. And so you need a comprehensive approach. The question people might put on the table as a counter argument is, yeah, that's a key perspective on humanity, on sustainability and thinking in linkages and in coordination. But why is that an issue for humanitarian action? Humanity, yes, humanitarian action. If we want to refocus on the core humanitarian mandate, shouldn't we focus on life-saving, human life-saving? What makes you believe, well, we even need to merge organizations, not only even the action, and that will pay off?
So I'm often wrong. You know, you've shown me I'm wrong already in this podcast. So I don't believe I'm right all the time, but I think we really have to take this idea seriously about expanding and taking a new view of humanity and the Earth community. I think, you know, if I'm honest, many NGOs, many humanitarian organizations, they pretend they go in and out of a place really quickly and they're charging around doing it. They never leave a place. They've been in the same landscape for decades. They've often been part of creating that landscape, if it's an IDP landscape and an IDP camp and a refugee camp. They have a responsibility to that landscape. And I actually think, at the end of the day, that we'll probably get better value for money, more sort of compassionate coherence, if we look at the needs of humans and nature together. And we seek, you know, what the Chinese and the Americans always call a win-win, you know, if we can work for both and focus on the mutualism that exists between humans and nature. That's the sweet spot. which happens in ecosystems, in water supplies, in nature-based solutions and things like that. Humanitarians are going to have to do that. And they do anyway. They're working with nature all the time anyway. So why not just come out and say, we love nature too?
It might provide an incentive to, oh yes, let's grow to become a climate humanitarian development organization at the same time. My former employer, WFP, loves to jump on such new mandates, et cetera. So it's let's see what comes out of that. Jumping on a final topic, what was striking for me when reading your really inspiring essay on this criteria, what was striking to me was that you rather, compared to these more political proximity issues, et cetera, you rather touched only on more practical operational questions, like the question how to prioritize between sectors, if you have to prioritize food security or health, what's more important in a given crisis, how to prioritize within a sector, like I know from my past with WFP, well, do we prioritize 500 babies needing nutritional food because otherwise we'll create the next chronic hunger generation, or use the same money, because nutritional food is very expensive, for 5,000 school kids to provide them a single meal a day, etc. Or, of course, prioritizing between crises and very, very expensive crises, like all the conflicts we talked about, Syria, Yemen, Syria, you usually pay five times more to save a life than an African in Somalia, in Kenya, an Ethiopian hit by a drought, but easily accessible, no safety issues, etc. Was there a reason why you didn't touch that much on these issues, where some people might say, well, isn't it more about impartiality to make it work in a practical sense and to provide guidance how to use impartiality in times of shrinking funds?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And, you know, I am aware very much that, you know, I haven't been an operational person for a long time. And so I hesitate in advising on hardcore operational ethics. So that's one reason. So I feel less guilty talking about sort of foundational big issue ethics. But I think the other thing is that, you know, it would take quite a second, you know, I'm having to write an essay or a blog. It would take a good couple of pages to really argue out that case between 500,000 newborn babies and 5,000 school children. You know, we're talking about consequentialism there in ethics, and it does have a place. And sometimes you should make the hard choice. You know, it's you say it very well. And people have to make that choice. And I'm very happy to have discussions about that. But I didn't have time in that blog. And also, I rather hope that if I put out some big sort of criteria, it might help people to have those very difficult discussions on the ground. But I am aware with my climate book, too, because my climate book is a sort of foundational ethics, too. It's sort of big picture values discussion. And I have a horrid feeling I'm going to have to write a sequel, which is actually, what do you do if you're, you know, do you save a cow or a person and all this stuff? So I'm going to have to probably do a sequel. But I think it's important to make some commitments first about what we value in the world, what we think is important. And then from those commitments, we'll have to have the very difficult discussions.
Would you agree that on this issue of practical operational prioritization, that not saying that should be the only question, but that the overall and very international debate about prioritization would benefit from a stronger focus on that part as well?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, and we know those decisions are always ghastly. We always have to make them. And we're going to have to make more of them in the climate emergency, because I think there will come a time when, you know, if... It's been a very interesting 2 years for me reading into climate for the first time and earth sciences and all these things, which I've never done before. And these tipping points are deeply alarming. Tipping points of temperature, tipping points of ice melt, tipping points of sea level rise, etc. Tipping points of massive new threats to health from heat. And if we really tip without positive tipping points first that prevent those tips, there's going to be some very difficult choices, which will very often be in the nature of triage.
Maybe finishing with a final question and a maybe more optimistic point you shared in this essay as well, I believe. What do you think? What comes out of the debate, and how will it evolve in the months and years to come? You wrote at some point, I quote, "I recognize that new geopolitics and expanding climate action provide more options for the division of humanitarian labor around the world." Was that an attempt to stop us being depressed, or what gives you hope that something good comes out of this and out of the whole debate?
Well, I'm rather optimistic. You see, this by nature, I can't really help it. I love life. I love the world. I love getting up in the morning. So I really hope it goes on. And I have great faith in human beings and human nature. And I think we're not going to get through, or we're not going to learn to live with the climate emergency without lots of people suffering, and there'll be winners and losers. But I really hope we will come through and find a way to make peace with nature, to find a new way to control the Earth's temperature, to find new sources of energy, which are actually rather miraculous and amazing. So I sort of remain an optimist. And I find that helpful and important. But the facts are really hard. But the world always has challenges. This is actually a challenge that's different, because it's a challenge about the world continuing, the world we need as a species to live. I mean, it'll go on anyway. So it is a more alarming prospect. But I have a feeling we'll find ways to get through.
Do you also have hope that, sometimes Michael Kurler said in our last podcast, never waste a good crisis for change and for creating momentum for reform. Do you think this geopolitical pressure, and even maybe the climate crisis pressure, can also help to
yes,
move reform in
and,
a good way?
Yeah, and the other thing that I'm optimistic about is that, I believe the scientists. I think they're, I think the hard science is probably pretty good and as good as we can get, and therefore we need to take that seriously. But I never believe the political scientists. Their predictions are usually rubbish. They always miss things, little things like the French Revolution.
Many thanks, Hugo. I'm a political scientist.
That's right. So I think we can be very confident that they'll be predicting the wrong things. And we may be extraordinarily surprised by a sudden entente between the great powers about this, a relaxing of the competition. We may be surprised by an extraordinary new movement of people, which says this is what we care about. Well, we don't know what's going to happen politically. We do, unfortunately, have a sense of what's going to happen scientifically. And so I remain confident that humans will find a way to find the right leaders, the right things. It'll be very messy, but I hope we will.
Hugo, many thanks for your optimism. Many thanks for your ongoing readiness to provoke us and the sector and to inspire us, because I think it's much needed. We talk a lot about reform and innovation, but we like to stick to the rules and the principles and don't like change, in fact, like nobody usually does. So really, please keep going and keep inspiring us. And many thanks for being here and many thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Ralph.
This is it today from the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. You can find all relevant links to this session in the show notes. If you have any feedback or a suggestion as to whom should be interviewed here, we'd love to hear that. Just send us an email to info@charberlin.org. Thanks for listening.